As we've been looking at this discourse on loving kindness, we've gone bit by bit through the text. And the text opens up from an initial invocation of like the foundations of practice in these beneficial qualities to cultivate in practice, ethical guidelines. And in the center of the text, it really opens into the core practice of loving kindness, which is this universal, unbounded, the texts use this term radiating loving kindness over the entire world. And so the practice of doing this means in some way figuring out how to take a feeling that we usually think of as really personal. You know, I care about these people, I care about this issue, I love these folks in a special way. All that's great. But to take that feeling and the clarity of intention and force for action that we generally funnel into a very limited number of relationships that we care about, and somehow expand both the feeling and, in a way, the action potential to cover everyone. And this is amazing that it could be this way, that this would be possible. And the main shift is from the personal to the impersonal. One of the things that's beautiful about this is that it parallels the wisdom that grows when Buddhist practice becomes mature and insight starts to deepen, that the thing I think of as the personal anyway can't really be kind of isolated from the rest, right? Not just in a relational way, like the way that when people are in solitary confinement, they go insane. Like, it's not just that we're social creatures and we need connection to be well. It's actually that everything about our being can't be separated from everything else. Right? The body is part of the ecosystem, trading molecules with the air constantly. We exist in a symbiotic relationship with the ecosystem of food and the elements. The language we use is completely embedded in culture. Language is collective, right? Ideas are collective. Most of your good ideas didn't come from you. They came out of the swirling, unfolding kind of fermentation of culture. And that's the original ones. Most of the rest are just repetition. It turns out that even the felt sense of myself, the way it's like, oh, well, this just feels like me. If I really look at it, that feeling is conditioned. It's embedded in like how I was taught to be a me. And different people are taught to be me in different ways, right? So like, it's clear now that the world is small through communication that folks in other cultures not only think about the world differently, but think about themselves differently, think about the body differently. We have a very strong ideology around individuality and separateness in many of the kind of post-European Enlightenment cultures, including America. But many cultures in the world don't have that particular quality as deeply enshrined. And certainly there are cultures like the cultures that are framed by some kind of Confucianism in East Asia, China and Japan and Korea most centrally, where one's identity is much more fully thought of than we do here as embedded in the family and the social roles, and that's really who you are, rather than this kind of separate, willful, I do whatever I want, fuck all y'all kind of, you know, individual. I mean, that's us, right? But that's, not everyone is like that. So this this wisdom that says, oh, my individuality actually starts to be seen through as a kind of fiction, and I can see that this thing that I am is interwoven with everything, is actually the same process, the same realization in a certain way, as the realization that says, oh, I can care for everyone the way I care for the ones that I focus on. Like, it's the same thing. Oh, they're not separate. Or all beings experience similar pains and sorrows. One metaphor in the texts says that, you know, when you get hurt on a part of your body, when you stub your toe or you cut your finger or something, there's no distance to your caring for that part of the body. It's not like you look down at your finger and you say, oh, you poor thing, you got hurt. I hope that goes well for you over there. You know, with some like, well, I'm fine. It's really too bad that you're hurt. Right? That distance doesn't exist. You just step in and you do the right thing. You wash it, you wrap it up, you take care of it. If we could actually get deeply in our bones, in our hearts, that all of life on the planet is one organism, that the organisms are inseparable from each other, that it's one complex living thing, our response then to someone else's suffering could be the same as our response to our own finger being cut. No distance, just like care. Immediate care, right? And not even in a certain way, care with a kind of overtone of emotional, like, oh no. I mean, sometimes I feel that. I'm like, oh no. But it's actually a different feeling. It's really just like, oh no. Right? There's not a kind of mushiness to it. So then this opens into the strange, in a way, paradox of caring for everybody. We learn to care for some people, and in a way our biology is built to only care for a few people. You know, one number I heard is about 100. Like, just about the size of a big extended family kind of tribe that we might have been connected to back in our nomadic times. That's about the number of people that you can really track and kind of know what their life drama is and what's happening for them and care in a personal way about them. I don't know how folks got to that number. Sometimes I feel so overwhelmed. I feel like three, you know, my sweetheart, my baby, and I try to sort of keep track of my family. And then there's that one friend over there that I'm like, I think I know what's happening for them. You know, and then I'm like, oh my God, I have 3,000 Facebook friends. What does that mean? I don't even know half these people. Like, how could I, right, in a way? Like, oh yeah, we met at an event. I don't know, we have friends in common. I just said yes, like, or just go away. Don't ask me things. How do you turn that quality that's like, maybe it's like, I care about you because I know you, into, I care about you because I know enough about you to know that you're worthy of care. And that's really kind of like, because you exist. That's it. Like, here you are, you're worthy of care. Or here we are, this is our body, and we just care in a kind of, not even worthy. My finger isn't worthy of care. I just care, right? I don't have to be like, do you deserve it? Do you deserve the Band-Aid? You haven't been very good today. You know, you picked my nose aggressively. Bad finger. No Band-Aid for you, right? I don't judge the action. I just take care of the wound. We talked about this a little last week when we addressed this difficult question that that Jen brought in, who isn't here tonight, but who you know, brought in 2 weeks ago the question about, like, folks being responsible for their actions and held accountable. And what does it mean to generate this kind of infinite or you know, unconditional care for folks? Does it mean that we kind of slip away from holding folks accountable or responsible for their actions? And so then last week we talked about the teaching of karma and how action and its results are always interwoven. And that this teaching proposes actually a challenge in suggesting that in a certain way we recognize that actions will always give rise to results. Therefore, everyone's automatically, in a certain way, responsible. But that doesn't mean they need to be blamed or punished. We talked a bit about prison and punishment and justice is kind of implied in here. So here's where we're at in the text. There's this whole invocation of this core practice of radiating kindness out to the entire world, caring for everyone without exception. And then the text says, you know, and without hatred, right? Not to despise any being in any state, without hatred and without ill will. And this is a deep practice to try to uproot those qualities from our hearts when there's still fear and scarcity in the heart. And then the text gives the core metaphor, which is a parental metaphor. So the next line is, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will. So this is the blasting outward from the most personal to the most impersonal. And it starts with the personal. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. And as I was coming over here, I was thinking about these two verbs. They're translations, of course, but they're decent translations. Protect and cherish. Even as a mother protects with her life, and then so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. I like cherish. Cherish, it's an old word. I'm like, you know, like I cherish my people. Like, it's so nice. It feels good in the mouth. Cherish. Protect is much fiercer, right? Protect. So I want to read into this some combination of this kind of the love quality of just radiating kindness, cherishing all living beings, valuing their existence, wishing for their well-being, and then protect, which is an action verb. And really says, do something. Protect. Make good boundaries. Care for in an active way. And the text is so kind of paradoxical. Like, a mother cares for her only child in a very only child kind of way, right? Like, I saw a documentary at one point that was talking about this group of folks. It was talking about kind of social politics in Central Asia, and it was interviewing these folks in a very poor village, rural village, and they interviewed a mother who had 22 children, and she had just kind of given birth to the latest one, and the interviewer was like, "What's it like having like child number 22?" And the mom kind of just rolled her eyes and she said, "More work." Like, that was it. at that point. Number 22, it's like more work. Johann Sebastian Bach had 23. The first 19 with one woman, and then the last four with another one. My heart sort of goes out to the first one more. I know. The last four, who are all children of Anna Magdalena, who herself became famous, they all became famous composers. The first 19, they didn't become famous composers. I don't know what happened. But 20, I can't even imagine. I have one now, and I'm like, I mean, this is enough. One is enough, right? So, the care for an only child is a really particular thing. And to go from there, so like, okay, protects with her life, her child, her only child, I get that, sort of, like, okay. But then, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. And it's interesting to me that the verb shifts. It doesn't say, so one should protect all living beings. And I think this is because the authors of this text, whether it's the Buddha mythically speaking it or the monastics that wrote it down, they know that protect in a way is going to be taken really literally. Like, you protect an only child. And so it's not, like, we know that you can't actually protect all living beings. And if you could, there wouldn't be a liberation path. It would just be like, well, protect everybody from harm. But what would that even mean? Like, keep them from dying? Keep them from ever experiencing loss? It's actually impossible to protect beings within the reality of life that includes gain and loss and pleasure and pain and birth and death themselves, old age and sickness. Which, of course, we go back to the mother and her child, and there's a way that, like, oh, and I feel this now as a papa. Like of course, I want to protect my child. And there's this way that, like, I know that I can't. It's amazing, you know. Even, like, he has a sort of rough moment, you know, at his nanny share with someone that's with his other best friend, you know, kid. And he comes home, you know, and he's like, you know, his sentence of the moment is, his name is River. We call him Rivy. He says, Rivy got sad. And then he tells us about what happened. And I'm like, oh no, you went out of my care into this, like, other place, and something happened, like, you know, that really was mostly like his friend grabbed the truck out of his hand that he was playing with, and he got sad. Like, that's where we're at right now. And he's like, Rivy got sad, you know, such and such, like, truck, mine, sad. And I'm like, I couldn't save you from that. Like, I couldn't protect him from that little thing, you know, or like, one day he got pushed, you know. He was in his way. But I'm just like, you can't push my kid. But of course, it's totally going to happen, like, over and over in a million ways. And it's like, oh, that's kind of amazing, heartbreaking. But it's like, oh, the mother protecting with her life even can't protect her child, ultimately, right? That's why there's a path of practice. So protect, when we radiate out to all beings, turns into cherish. It's almost like, how could it not? Right? That's what you can do. So then, cherish all living beings. And then it recapitulates the core meditative or contemplative practice, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, and then the quality that it has to have, freed from hatred and ill will. And this is the purification we talked about in the earlier parts of the text. So I posted this article on Facebook yesterday or something. There was a really interesting writing by a monk in my tradition who was saying a little bit like the Buddha didn't talk that much about social action because he was really concerned with liberation and in a way recognizing that, that social action can fall into the trap of thinking that it can succeed, that you could actually alleviate some kind of material suffering or fact of oppression, and then the suffering will be gone. That there could be some kind of success to justice. And so then I posted that, and then I was thinking with some different people about some of the implications in it. And one of them, in a way, is this, that we can want, like, it's core to compassion practice to want beings to be safe, right? And to be held in safety and care. And it's core to wisdom to recognize that everything changes all the time, that there's dissatisfaction, and that nothing can be held on to permanently. And I think that as I've been sort of thinking about this today and yesterday, after this article, really feeling some, almost the poignancy of the way that so many folks and myself in some ways are really committed to certain kinds of social action because there are oppressions right now that I feel like just must be answered with action. And at the very same time to hold that action will always forever be limited. There's only so much that can be solved on the material or relational plane. And it needs to be done. But it will never be the end. And that actually that action has to go on forever. Like that's part of like, there's ill will and hatred in the world, therefore there must be restorative and wise action against oppression. So that's the scene, right? And then the Buddhist teachings come in and they say, see with wisdom that's the scene. See that really clearly. There will always be greed, hatred, and delusion. These are the roots of distress. They are inexhaustible, the text says. And then, therefore, there's always the struggle against them. There will always be a good fight to be had on behalf of those who are suffering. And then the teachings come in and say, if that's the only model, and this was a huge model for a very long time, the battle between good and evil is at the heart, in some ways, of Christianity, of an early tradition called Manichaeism, and another early tradition called Zoroastrianism, really said like, oh, this is what's happening. There's a battle between good and evil. Buddhism comes in and says, no, see with wisdom that is the nature of conditioned existence. That will always be the case. There is a third way, and that third way is to step out of the conflict and see it clearly in such a way that something transforms in one's own heart. And the imperative to fight disappears. This is challenging for those who want to who really respect the need to fight, to protect in an active way those who are oppressed, and at the same time cultivate a practice of equanimity or wisdom or even unbinding, nirvana, liberation. And so then there's this paradox at the heart of socially engaged or active Buddhism, where engagement and liberation pull at each other. And maybe there's always a tension between the two. And this really clarified in Buddhist history when the Mahayana tradition really leaned hard on the engagement side, and they came up with a new archetype for the enlightened being. It's not the Buddha or the arahant, the perfected ones, who are fully released from suffering. It was the bodhisattva who chooses out of compassion to remain engaged forever. Or who chooses to become a Buddha quickly in order to be engaged in a deeper, more profound way. And so then there's always been, always 2,000 years, there's been this tension within the religion of engagement and liberation. And they always kind of vibrate in each other's presence. But it's a very, very old question within the tradition. How much to let go and how much to reach in and try to fix something. So, yeah, let's open to conversation. Please, Peter.
What is it like Gita? you do the act, you engage in the battle because it's the Dharma. It's the right thing to do without any attachment to winning the battle.
Well, that's the Gita. It's a really different tradition.
Yeah, that's...
The Gita's Buddhist influenced.
You know, the Dharma is to do the right.
Right. Dharma doesn't mean that in the Buddhist system.
Oh.
So the word is used really differently. And there, but yeah, it's a... Peter's speaking to a doctrine in the Hindu Vedanta scripture known as the Bhagavad Gita, called Nishkama Karma. Nish meaning without, kama desire, karma action. So desireless action. And the teaching is do what is right for your duty or your place in the social order, but do it with equanimity. Do it without attachment to results. And this is a way to simultaneously renounce engagement and remain engaged. And some scholars think that it was actually a very kind of profound and skillful maneuver on the part of some Hindu almost like the folks who were crafting the religion at that time to in a way fight back against the strength of Buddhism at that moment, which was really gaining thousands and thousands of adherents and really who were becoming monastics, who were renouncing very fully. The renunciate path was getting a lot of people out. And the Gita comes along and says, oh, you don't have to do that. You can be a layperson and engaged as long as you do it with this special quality that's like an inner renunciation. So it was a really interesting way to kind of bring those two things into contact.
Yeah, but I see a target who, as a mother, protects their only child.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at it as a mother with a tiger mom who will kill to protect that child from any pain.
Right.
Or you could look at it as with the attitude of absolute selflessness.
Yeah.
Without
for
any
sure.
attachment for themselves.
Yeah.
They will do anything. They will give their life. They'll take the bullet. They'll cut off their
sure.
arm, feed the child, and starve. And then
yeah.
it's not a contradiction with cherishing all humanity.
It's true, and this jumps us to another religion. I was about to say, haha, without even thinking that I was saying it. I was like, yeah, if I could give my life in order to save all beings, like, well, I would. And I'm like, oh, right, this guy, he did that. That's Jesus. Like, that's an entire tradition built around that exact model, that like, what if it were possible for one being with this profound connection to reality to do a single act of compassionate sacrifice and save everyone from torment? Like, that's kind of an incredible transaction. That's the technical term in Catholicism. It's called a transactional system, transactional salvation. And So that's not the Buddhist model. It's a really incredible model. It's the model I grew up in. But
that's not what a bodhisattva does.
It's
giving up liberation.
Well, it... Yeah. We have to talk more about bodhisattvas because it's a... It's complex. You know, bodhisattva practice is tied in with emptiness practice. So, you know... It's more like, in order to save all beings, first you have to realize that there's no such thing as all beings. That's one of the Bodhisattva teachings. So, right, you have to get full emptiness, and then as soon as there's no beings, as soon as one being is liberated, all beings are liberated. Or, as soon as one being realizes that there's no such thing as a dichotomy between liberation and non-liberation, or between an individual being and all beings are liberated by being not liberated. This is, if you really want to like, mind blow in this direction, the text to read is called the Diamond Sutra. And I'll point, I would say read Red Pine's translation of it if you do. It's gorgeous and stunning, you know, in this direction. We'll talk about it at some point. Maybe we'll do a read-through of it someday. Really big emptiness teaching. But other thoughts here on this, like, protect, cherish all beings, how to act in the world, kind of action and renunciation. What do you think?
I was interpreting it as a mother protecting with her life as a practice.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I was thinking about that in the context of been struggling with how to hold my daughter, and she's 15, and she's got some depression. Mm-hmm. And when she's really in a depressed state, she whines a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the whining, it's so hard. It's so, like, there isn't an immediate I come in with care when when the wine comes. I come in with, like, so part of what I've been working with is my practice around how do I come in with something that can hold her.
Yeah.
The wine comes from this feeling of, like, powerlessness and helplessness and... So how do I meet that? And that's about my doing my own practice to protect her from my reactivity around what comes up when she whines.
Yeah. This is beautiful. I love it. Yeah. It reinterprets with her life, as in with your whole life practice force being, you're going to come in and do this protecting. Yeah. I'm like, oh no, there's going to be a... I'm still in the phase where, like, any amount of distress can be kind of resolved by just holding him for long enough.
Yeah.
Tell me it isn't so.
This is not...
Yeah. This is impermanent, you're saying.
Can I just say...
Please.
First of all, thank you for sharing that. Something that brings up other things. I really appreciate it. But there's also the piece when you're talking about river that you can protect your child like a lioness, and you think you're doing the right thing by protecting them from harm, and it's not till 15, 20 years later that you realize, oh, you weren't letting them stand in their own power. And your intentions can be all altruistic, but then they can't cope with stress or whatever, because you so protected them, and you're so benevolent in your intention, but you messed up or whatever, and you know, and so it's such a deep thing, you know, when we that relationship, and because you're not all knowing in your love, and you just do the best you can, you know, and so it's very profound. You know, this whole thing that you guys are talking about. Because there's also that element of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, with my parents, to me, they didn't mean to mess me up in what their stuff, you know, that I was so indignant about. They don't even realize that they just thought they're doing the best thing to have me strive and be, you know, neurotic. But it's just amazing that whole transfer that goes from generations. Mm-hmm. Deep stuff, isn't it?
This was part of our reflection last week, was like, what if actually everyone who's doing harm is actually, like, could be wrong, but is, like, doing the best thing they could figure out how to do to try to yeah. make a good result.
Right.
Like, whose parents actually intend to harm them? Very few.
Yeah.
The occasional really bad ones. But mostly, folks actually are kind of doing the best they can. And sometimes that's terrible. And sometimes it's like, just like ordinary bad, you know? And sometimes it's like pretty good, but not perfect, right? And what happens to our sense of almost like forgiveness for everyone if we actually got that that was true across the board? Everyone is doing the best they can all the time. Yeah, I'm glad we have a bunch of moms here today.
Yeah. That's good. I've been there. Thank you for sharing. Thank you. And there came a point where it actually helped me with that angst to remember that I was feeling that because she's my daughter. But there are how many, you know, thousands, millions of people in that state who also have a mother. And that kind of helped me with a certain amount of wholesome equanimity with it. Because I mean, what I'm hearing is maybe you're trying to navigate between empathy and compassion. And so then I come to my daughter and I can't stand to see her like that. And then it's very hard for her to see me like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do I come to her with compassion rather than empathy?
Mm-hmm.
And so when I kind of, I mean, it was much later than her being 14, it dawned on me, you know, this idea that everybody out there who's suffering at least as much as my daughter is also has a mother and a father and loved ones who are feeling that too. And so then it kind of dispersed it in a way, not a lot, but it did something. So it, yeah, it's a toughie. Yeah, my daughter's 30 now, so
still working on it.
Still working on it. Yeah.
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 I can remember being that age, and I was really difficult at 15. And I remember feeling like I really needed to find my own way, and that the suffering meant something to me. And there was something there that I needed to find. And a lot of times the kind of the interaction that I got from adults, I felt really resentful of it in a way. And I don't think I could have expressed it at the time. But I think there was a lot of a lot of the anger that came up around my suffering was just like the inability to figure out for myself what needed to happen or what was going on or where I wanted to go in life or not even that. Yeah, but I think I really needed a lot of space and especially emotions. My parents could feel very difficult to deal with, an extra burden. And I kind of realize as I'm saying this, I don't want it to sound like I'm being, oh, you're such a burden. I don't mean that at all. But I think there comes a time when, you know, it kind of at that adolescent age where it's you kind of you just need to find your own person somehow.
That's what my 18-year-old is feeling. But no, I don't think. I feel that push-pull tension is so important, and trying to figure out the role. Everyone needs space to do their own figuring out.
Yeah.
And we all need holding and care when we're doing
that. And I'm sure I needed a lot more than I realized at the time. That was kind of the baseline, even though it was also frustrating. It was
I feel that's why I like that word cherish too, because it does, there's an intimacy to it, but there's also maybe a little bit of formality. Maybe you cherish a piece of china or something.
Right.
But it's not a grasping.
Yeah.
Stickiness.
Yeah. I hear something in this, in what each of you are saying, each of the folks that have spoken, around like qualities of care that are on, you know, a spectrum between like kind of close in and holding and sort of like what are the boundaries that I'm providing, and then like spaciousness and allowing and opening outward, and that, you know, and that of course that's dynamic when you're in a relationship like that, like sometimes really close in and sometimes like lots of space. Thinking about the parental child role as the archetype in this text of like how one should care for everyone, this conversation is making me think a little bit about like, oh, you know, the thing that a child needs the parent to be in some ways is just to be the parent. Like to, this comes from back to what Peter's saying about Dharma and the role, like to just be the role. And that's going to mean, you know, different things at different times, more boundary, more limitation, less boundary. But it seems to help when the parent is at least like stable in their identity as parent, like embodies the role, and then in a way it's a solid place for then the force of the growing child just to kind of bounce off of. I think that was the case for me. I mean, yeah, I think my folks did a medium job. You know, hi guys out there, you're all right. Good enough. Totally. Seems to have turned out okay. You know, I'll give him that. Didn't feel great at the time, but there was a sense of at least like they never wavered in being who they were. Like they were always like the parents, you know. And I was privileged to have two of them that stayed alive and together for my whole growing up. Which isn't always the case, but they did the role, and in a way they did the dharma, to use the Gita's term of dharma, you know, they did parental dharma, and in that sense could stand in their place, could do the protect, meaning just like I make this space, and then maybe the child bounces around and does their thing, is available for holding or is not. I'll tell you more about that in 10 years when I have to deal with a tween. Any other thoughts here? Yeah.
It feels confusing to me, the idea that because there will always be suffering, we shouldn't. I'm trying to recall what you were saying, because I feel like you made a dichotomy of liberation versus something. I don't know if it was social action, but because I'm still so attached to the idea of social action.
Totally.
Because
me too.
I feel like even knowing that, yes, there will always be suffering, but maybe we can just like even it out a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And how, thinking about how use this to have more of that approach, where you still are able to act and not. I don't. Something about it felt passive, and then I had like this kind of confusion.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's why I kind of just, you know, use the word. It feels like just the paradox of it. I don't think of them as completely in conflict, but I think of them as a little bit. And again, let's come out of the binary and say that it's a spectrum. So there's a spectrum, we'll call it the spectrum of engagement, where where full engagement is like the entirety of my life force is channeled toward working with the material and relational conditions that are, you know, present now, with the aim to improving them for people's well-being. And then the other end, that's the engagement pole. The liberation pole would then be, from a Buddhist perspective, all of my life force is going towards seeing clearly with wisdom the roots of distress and uprooting them from my own being, uprooting hatred and judgment from my own being, which is going to, you know, it's not that they're incompatible. The thing that I was writing on in this sort of in this Facebook comment thread was just that there's actually just not enough time in the life to give your full life to each one. Like, they both take deep dedication. So the far poles are, you can't do both fully. And so this is why monastics become monastics and go fully in one direction. And, you know, activists become activists and go fully in one direction. But it's a spectrum, and there's all this space in between, and almost nobody actually lives at the far poles of, like, absolute renunciation. You know, a few. I met a Tibetan monk who had spent 30 years in a cave. And I'm like, okay, I'm not going to do that, you know. But I know activists who just, like, live and breathe social justice work, but also burn out by the dozens, right? And so, like a lot of things in the Buddhist framework, we could use this term the middle path or a middle way to talk about this. Like, what for you or for any one of us is like the right balance? You know, we're not monastics yet, anyway, or at the moment. I was one. Some of you might future be one, but none of us are right now. So we do this thing where we, like, even for half an hour at a time, we sit down, and for a moment we're not taking direct action. We're resting into the body breathing and the rising and falling of inner feeling and energy. And that tiny practice is a liberation practice. We're disengaging from the fight for a moment. And then maybe I go home and I, like, email my senators and I, you know, do some organizing and I get mad and I have a conversation and I cry about something. And, you know, like and I move toward action. And then in the morning I get up and I sit and I let it rest. And so, like, somewhere in the middle, there's this oscillation between kind of just these two qualities. And you can just think of them as two qualities. You know, when do I have my hands in the dough, like kneading it, and when do I just kind of let it rise on its own and go off and take a nap and take care of myself in a different way? So the paradox that I'm speaking to is really just that there's this doctrine that says profound liberation comes when you let go completely. And then there's the obvious reality that so much needs to be done in the world and so much needs help. And as if you're someone who really, whose heart is moved by this tradition and by the hint of renunciation in this tradition, then it's just kind of vibrant to hold both of those things and to be like, yes, deep letting go means there's going to be suffering always, right? And something else can happen when I take my hands out for a moment. And then when or how or what is it to know that my hands are needed in and to do more? And so just like, how do you hold both of those in exactly the balance for each of us, right? And it's going to be different for everyone. To clarify a little bit, make sense?
Yeah, I think it's also interesting to think about how to use the tools that you learn with bringing in liberation practice to engage in the more. Like, how can you call your senators with ease?
Yeah.
Without it being like a meeting as much as like carrying it into that work, which I think helps make that work sustainable, and like helping, making the goal, spreading liberation for other people, instead of like a type of doing work for them that doesn't help them learn that as well.
Yep. Yep.
Like, yeah, those pieces.
This is totally the thing. This is fully the thing. If calling the senators is the result of being mad as hell, I can only do it a few times before I'm toast. Mm-hmm. But you know. You know, I think this was Emma Goldman saying, you know, if I can't dance, it's not my revolution. Like, call them joyfully and be like, hi, have a great day. Don't do what you're doing. Thanks. You know, like, and then I think, like, letting it go also. And the beautiful piece that you mentioned, this is really, I think, very key. So I'm glad you're bringing it in. We haven't gotten there yet. Is that there can really be this core motivation for serving others, not that the goal is like, may I end their suffering, you know, like in some material way, but actually, may I create the conditions for more people to do liberation practice, which requires safety and ease and basic well-being, you know. So this is super important. You can do all of your action with the love of liberation practice as your motivation. I think that's a really beautiful pathway in. So I'm glad you're saying that. That's our time for tonight. It's a delight to be with you. It's a good place to pause for the evening. So thanks, moms, for being here. And everyone. The group, as always, is offered fully within the practice of the gift economy. So your offering of your resources supports the studio and myself to continue to make the group available for everyone who can come, regardless of resources. So thank you for your generosity there. What you offer is split between the studio and myself. In a different way than it was before, but I'm getting paid just fine by them. Supports the studio to give us the space. There's a little mailing list over there if you're not on it. You want to hear occasional things from me about stuff coming up. So, yeah, blessings. We'll carry on. It'll probably take us like 2 more weeks to get through the text. And the last two verses are stunning. The text goes from this where we've gotten so far, which is all sort of a piece, and it takes a sharp kind of non-dual or liberation turn at the end, and suggests profound liberation in the last line, by not holding to fixed views. So we'll talk about views and wisdom and all of that. Either next week or the week after. So, see you soon.